We are joined live in the KODX studios by Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. No, as we had pointed out last week, no Maria for the next this week and next week.
That's correct.
So you and I are just holding down the fort. So
God
help us.
Ballots arrive in 10 days, so next week we'll start getting into the general election. We'll talk a little bit about PAC contributions this week, but next week we'll start talking about the actual candidates.
All right.
And ballot measures. There's a few of those, too.
And that will probably, that could very well stretch a couple of weeks. With,
yes. You know, well, that was the idea, is because Maria could then weigh in when she gets back.
Yeah.
Which is always important.
It is. She always should have the last word.
Yes.
So
to hear her tell it.
Yes. As we both know.
She's not listening, I hope.
I'm pretty sure she's not. All right. So couple items before we get into the larger news bits. A local activist that we both know, and actually many of our listeners know and love, had an accident this week.
Yeah, Dorley Ramey, nonagenarian, I think it is. She's in her 90s. She fell and broke her hip this past Tuesday. So she's been in the hospital this week, and hopefully she'll recover fully. You know, it's always difficult for people that age, but on the other hand, as we mentioned before we got on the air, she is one of the strongest people either of us has ever met. So hopefully she will recover from that. We also had, of course, Bernie Sanders having a heart issue this week and having a couple stents put in for an arterial blockage.
Yeah, and, papers are calling it a heart attack now.
Yes, and hopefully he will recover from that and get back on the campaign trail soon. He is also somebody who, for his age, is remarkably active and had been keeping up a brutal campaign schedule. So hopefully he will fully recover. And then since whistleblowers have been much in the news lately, I thought I should mention Joe Wilson passed away this week. People may remember him from the Bush era, the last time we had insanity going on in the Oval Office. He was the person who debunked the yellow cake uranium hoax that Dick Cheney and friends were trying to perpetrate to say that, I believe it was Niger, was exporting to Iraq to make nuclear weapons. And he was the ambassador there at the time and debunked that. And for his efforts, his wife, Valerie Plame, who was a covert CIA officer, was outed by the Cheney crew. Which is Scooter Libby was prosecuted for that, but it probably went much deeper than that. And she is running for Congress now, so she lost her husband this week, and that was a sad loss.
Yeah, she's got a very popular campaign video making the rounds on social media.
Yes,
that
I've seen it too.
Yeah. All right. Well, then diving into
starting on a more upbeat note.
Yeah. Right. Diving into local events, a couple quick items. I saw this week that 11 people, 350 Seattle, reported that 11 people, allies, were arrested this week doing protests at four Chase Bank branches in Seattle. And that was to encourage the bank to divest from their fossil fuel.
Yes, and Chase has also been notorious in the past for being one of the main financiers of the Keystone XL pipeline. So they're neck deep in the energy sector and have been facing a lot of activist pressure to try and divest from those investments. So,
one of the many sectors they invest in that don't appear to be helping the planet at
all. It's kind of problematic, yeah.
Yeah, the big banks.
But J.P. Morgan Chase, that's what the full name is.
All right. And then related to that, also this week there was a trial for Donald Zepeda being found guilty for his attempts to shut down the Trans Mountain Pipeline back in 2017. People had expected him, at least those attending the trial, had expected him not to be found guilty, but he was found guilty of three counts: burglary, attempted sabotage, and malicious.
Yeah, that was up north. I believe it was in Skagit County.
Right.
The actual original action was in Anacortes.
So, and his sentencing is October 17th. So,
we will let you know.
We will. Also this week, Cafe Vita getting some heat for an email and some of their policy decisions.
Well, they actually fired several employees who had been giving out vouchers and pastries and coffee and whatever else to homeless people, which, you know, a lot of that stuff, especially the pastries, it gets thrown out at the end of the day.
Right.
Cafe Vita's email, the now former general manager is Isaiah Washington, sent an email to current and former employees laying out the policy that basically made the case that giving food or food cards to the homeless just basically encourages homelessness, which has been a right-wing canard for years and years and years, and it's simply not true. I would encourage anybody who thinks it is true to try living on the streets for a couple of days and see if the free things you can get here and there make up for all the hardships that you go through. I don't think it does. Cafe Vita is looking not very good this week.
So, and to be specific, it's the Cafe Vita. They have multiple outlets, but the Cafe Vita up on Capitol Hill.
Yes.
So. And then finally, the Mecca Cafe has reopened, and people are questioning that because it's a new operation from that Dave Minert is running. And
yes, all those sexual harassment charges didn't change the fact that Minert is now a very wealthy player in the local restaurant scene, and he purchased the rights to the Mecca Cafe, and hopefully it has been aired out now because. God knows it took about 3 years for the smoke to clear out after this indoor smoking ban. It's a really traditional dive bar up in Lower Queen Anne. And, for people who like that kind of thing, it's kind of a good fit for Minert's brand. But, he still has a lot of accusations dogging him and dogging his businesses.
Actually sexual assault, I think, was what he was. Sexual assault and rape was
that was at least one of them.
So, so moving on, then Seattle City Council has been very busy this week. They're in budget hearings from now, pretty much until the end of the year.
No, the end of they hope to get the full budget passed by Thanksgiving, generally, right. And that's what they're aiming for this year. So there'll be another 4 weeks or so of hearings, and then the various department recommendations will go out of committee to the full council, and they'll vote on it as a package, and hopefully make some major amendments to Mayor Durkin's proposed budget.
All right.
Because some of them are quite problematic. But they also passed a number of renter protections this week, five different bills to be exact. Some of them were technical, but some of them were not. Most important probably was the bill now to be signed into law that would prevent landlords from charging for damages due to domestic violence to their victims when they move out. And there was one person who testified at a city council committee this week that held up a bill for almost $4,000 from a landlord for, a bodily fluid cleanup that happened when the victim's mother suffered a skull fracture at the hands of her, at the hands of the abuser. That sort of thing is what council wanted to put an end to, and they have. That doesn't cover just domestic violence, though. It also covers sexual assault, sexual harassment, and stalking. Another bill that's important is that they enacted a bill that would allow family members to be able to live in an apartment or a condo or whatever is being leased, so long as it doesn't violate the restrictions on the number of people who can live in a unit, that they don't have to be on the lease, that they can actually come in as family members. That's something council was looking at as being abused under the very lax current or past landlord practices. And, for the domestic violence one, they looked at statistics saying that almost all the people in King County who were evicted from due to domestic violence or had to move out due to domestic violence in this past year wound up being homeless, at least for a time, or couch surfing or transitional shelter or whatever it might be. That's something that they were trying to prevent as well. So that homelessness. So at least the person will still have to fend for housing, but they won't have to face a huge bill from the landlords. So that's all good news.
Yeah.
And credit to Lisa Herbolt, who's fighting for re-election right now, for initiating that bill.
All right.
That got through council.
All right. Are there other related items to that particular?
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the budget hearings.
Okay. All right. So also on Wednesday, again, with talking about the budget hearings, they had been focusing that afternoon specifically talking about the LEAD program, which is a successful diversion program.
Yes,
started
that,
here.
That Mayor Durkin has been underfunding because she just wants to arrest people instead.
Yeah, and again, a very such a well-known program and successful that it is being used as a model, being exported to other cities.
Yes.
Lisa Dugard, who was the person that put that together and or helped put that together. I believe she was the primary person on that.
Yes, public defender and very active civic activist.
Just recently got recognized as, oh man, and now it eludes me. She just got like a major award for a genius award.
Oh, good. MacArthur?
Yes.
Oh, just, good for her.
She was one of two people in Seattle that got the friggin' MacArthur Award for her work on this. So she was at the hearing too, and again, just showing how important this program is, and basically wrestling to get additional funding and not have funding cut back for this program.
Yeah.
So
you have some audio from that?
Yeah. So they were discussing this, and sitting around, one of the people sitting at the table was Seattle Police Department was being represented there, and. And Chief Deputy Chief Mark Gareth Green was responding to his interpretation of the success or lack thereof of the LEAD program, and it turned out to be a heated discussion because they'd also another item they'd been talking about was the recent ramp up, which began in July of this year from Durkin's office for arresting prostitutes. Sex workers up on Aurora,
and right.
Originally they had ramped that down for years now, and because they recognize that is not the way to go. That is not
helpful.
No, not at all. And so anyway, Durkin, as part of her new brochure plan to appease the tourist industry, I guess, and or the folks over at Safe Seattle. And,
yeah, the screaming hyenas.
And, yeah.
Had Trump supporters.
And in addition to doing the emphasis patrols, was focusing on Aurora and other things. And anyway, so we have that actual, some of the audio from that on Wednesday, and just wanted to share a few minutes of that with you.
Sure.
It's radio.
Oops. Let's try.
Thank you. So when we deal with complex situations like we have in Seattle, the intersection of mental health, substance abuse, homelessness, and property crimes as such, I don't believe that there is a one-size-fits-all solution. That we have to have as many resources as we can to offer to folks. And it's not through enforcement. Enforcement is actually the last line, in my opinion, of this. But to have those resources available to the officers to do that type of thing. There's, a little misinformation that at the direction of change of enforcement in the North Precinct was not due to the inability to get people into LEAD. It was due to the fact that we did not believe, I did not believe, that LEAD was a good solution for a lot of those folks up there. We have a prostitution problem in the North Precinct. No good deed goes unpunished, and when law enforcement together with the community came together and shut down Backpage and Craigslist ads, they forced a lot of those women who were making their livelihood from the websites from the phone books out onto the streets as well. We have people that are working the streets that aren't necessarily substance abuse. They have homes. Some of them choose to do what they're doing. We need to have some type of intervention with them, whether it be LEED or something else. But we have to address these types of things. To simply go about doing the same thing over and over again becomes problematic if it does work for some but not for others. We've had two homicides in the North Precinct on Aurora directly related to prostitution activities. I have to do something in order to make that population safe as well. And so when we do it, I would like to say just one moment, please, ma'am, I firmly believe in LEED. I believe we should fund LEED. All I'm saying is I need a lot of resources to deal with the complex problems that we have out there.
Thank you for concluding that way, that you believe we ought to fund LEED. I think that for me, and I could just feel some of the hackles raising with some of my colleagues, the idea that we can conclude that women are prostituting themselves for a choice is something that is almost shocking to even say. We consider it much more of a survival crime, and to the extent that we can help these people through investing a few million dollars more into the precinct so that you have those options, I'm feeling very strongly up here that it's going to have that support. And so, Councilmember Mosqueda, did you?
Yeah, thank you, Madam
and
Chair.
And then Councilmember Sawant.
You're talking about people on Aurora making choices. The only person making a choice in terms of prostitution are the Johns who are stopping to see if people are willing to get in their car. Those folks who are working on the street are not making a daily choice to go out there. They have, in many cases, resorted to the last option to sustain. If you read the articles repeatedly, you will see people are sustaining themselves, their families, their kiddos. This is not a choice people are making. As in, they're housed and they have all access to health services and they feel economically stable. People don't make this choice. So to me, it underscores the question that you've been asking of these other programs. Where is the data? If you want these organizations to be held accountable to meeting some standard of data that you're trying to get people to prove their effectiveness, and you're basing referrals for arrest instead of to LEED based on your assumption or gut or sense that somehow it was better to arrest them than get them into LEED, I want to see the data. I'd also like to see data that shows that people are making this choice, because absolutely, in my 15 years of working on this issue, from human trafficking and labor trafficking and standing up for workers' rights, I have never been so shocked by such an assertion.
And I appreciate that, Madam Councilwoman. And that comes from my experience of actually working the street up there and talking to a young lady who specifically told me that she was there to make money and enjoyed it. But beyond that, and I still believe that that young lady had
this
some.
This is just not acceptable that you're speaking this way. Did you just say that they're enjoying it? I mean,
that's her words, not mine. But what I'd like to say,
I don't think you should be speaking for women
certainly
at all, and much less women, much less in the context of the statistics, worldwide statistics, that the people who get into sex work primarily get into it because of financial constraints imposed on them by the system. That does not mean that we're going to sit and litigate every single woman's choice. That is not the point here. We're not going to question anybody's choice, but at the same time, we're not going to pretend that the overwhelming statistics don't exist, that overwhelmingly women and LGBTQ people get into this because of financial constraints. I mean, can we at least keep reality in front of us? I mean, so many of you come here and talk about data and data-driven and performance metric, and it's all about data. Well, you're not looking at the data at all, and just the language you're using is just simply not acceptable. And I also want to know how much interaction the police department has had with organizations like the Sex Workers Outreach Project, who will tell you a lot, because I think the police department needs to understand it clearly. If you're, it's not about you individually, but what you're saying reflects, at the minimum, a deep ignorance about just the whole context of sex work.
Thank you, Shama. And I would add to that, that was a remarkable piece of audio. Thank you, Mike, for getting that and for KODX being able to obtain audio like that.
Well, you're good.
The remarkable thing that Assistant Chief Green said there was he's basing his entire assertion upon a conversation with one woman. Now, that woman may be telling him what he wanted to hear. We don't know the context of the conversation. She may have just been arrested, blah, blah, blah. But even if true, it speaks for one woman. It doesn't speak for all the women and young gay men who are up on Aurora. And Shamo is absolutely right there. You know, if you're talking about data for all these other programs, where's the data on that? Because the data overwhelmingly shows that it's a survival choice. Or it's they're being forced to it by a pimp, and there's a domestic violence issue there too. So it's shocking to me that SPD is taking that kind of attitude.
Yeah, and as others have pointed out, you know, with the current city's focus on arresting sex workers up there, there appears to have been no focus so far on arresting pimps, you know, and or arresting the Johns.
Right.
So, you know, it's just mind-boggling. It boggles the mind,
yeah,
as you used to say.
Well, go back to the 1950s, because that's clearly what SPD wants to do.
Yeah. Well, and again, they are being directed by Durkin's office.
Yes.
So, coming from the top.
Yes, in the context of a Department of Justice that doesn't care what they do anymore.
Apparently, although that's still yet to be worked out. So,
well, there's a federal judge overseeing the reform process that was agreed to in the Obama administration. But in terms of actual new abuses, none of it's being investigated at any local level by the DOJ.
Mm. Good point. All right. Well,
and SPD is well aware of that.
Yeah. Well, we could go on this actually on tangents of local issues that we actually don't have time for. And when I say local, I'm talking about university observations that I've seen.
Yeah.
With the lack of action on SPD's part. But that is another show. Let's instead move on, because we have a major, as you pointed out, ballots are in the mail in 10 days.
Yes, this
okay.
is 16th of October.
But that means that several...
15th, I'm sorry.
Numerous local PACs, which appears almost like every week that there's a new PAC being created.
Well, yeah, and this is a critical time for campaigns in terms of, you know, buying their final direct mail to be mailed out, buying their final media buys. So getting cash in hand right now is very important, and a lot of it is coming through third-party spending, through conservative PACs. We've seen an explosion of money in conservative PACs this year, most notoriously with the Case PAC from the Chamber of Commerce, which spent $29,000 this week on Egan O'Ryan's campaign in District 3. There'll be a lot more of that coming in the next couple of weeks, I'm sure. We've also seen the Seattle Firefighters PAC being very active. The Rich People for Seattle PAC has been... And these have all been getting contributions in as well as spending money on campaigns. They're getting contributions $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 at a time. So there's a lot of money pouring into these city council races in particular that we've simply never seen before in local elections. The primary beneficiaries of that this week have been Mark Solomon in District 2, Egan O'Ryan, as I mentioned, in District 3, running against Shama Sawant, and then Heidi Wills running in District 6. Against Dan Strauss. And we'll talk about all those races in the next couple weeks. But it's a very good time to be paying attention to, you know, when you get flyers in the mail, look at where those flyers came from, because they often don't come from the campaigns themselves. They're negative hit pieces coming from, say, the chamber who wants to get Shama and Sawant and Lisa Herbold out of office, or prevent Tammy Morales from getting into office, or Dan Strauss. So Heidi Will seems to be a particular beneficiary that we didn't see in the primary, but she's garnering a lot of support from these PACs this time around.
She did get some in the primary.
Yes, she did. And she got...
But now that it's down to just two people in each race.
Yes. She didn't get the kind of money that Districts 1, 2, and 3 got for Phil Tavel in District 1 running against Lisa Herbold, and then Mark Solomon in District 2 running against Tammy Morales, And as I mentioned, you go to Ryan and, you know, Ryan in District 3.
But it would make sense if you're a PAC and you've got, like, I mean, some of those races had, you know, half a dozen people in them, you know.
Sure.
You're going to.
Or a dozen. Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to theoretically spend, I was going to say your money, but it's really other people's money wisely. So yeah, it's down to the wire. And so, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah. And the other, beneficiary in District 4, the University District, is Alex Peterson, who's running against Sean Scott, who's a Democratic Socialist of America member. And the council would very much like to prevent him from getting on council, as well as Shama Sawant and Tammy Morales. And it really underscores, when I talked a couple minutes ago about the domestic violence bills, those kind of bills may not pass in the new council if the new council swings to becoming heavily business-oriented. You know, because the landlord lobby in that case would have a lot more impact. A lot of the contributions to these PACs are coming from developers, local developers and big money developers in town. Names you would recognize and some names you wouldn't. But it's definitely deep-pocketed because they've made a lot of money in recent years because it's been open season in Seattle. And they'd like to keep it that way or make it even more so.
Yeah, I was just, again, looking at the list today, which you can check out at the Seattle...
Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission.
Thank you. Website.
Yes, SEEC.
And
they have all the breakdowns of all the financial filings that the different campaigns and the independent PACs are spending on these races. It's very helpful to look at.
Yeah. Names I didn't recognize ponying up, you know, between like $10,000 and $25,000, mm-hmm, into a race, you know. It's like, I mean, you got to be making some pretty good money to be able to, like, throw that away on a friggin' election campaign.
Yeah, or you think it's an investment and you're going to get it back when that person is elected to council because they'll do your bidding, which sadly there's a long history of in Seattle. Hmm. So it's not necessarily a stupid investment.
No. If you've got, again, if you've got that kind of money to.
Yes. Alternatively, a number of campaigns, particularly Tammy Morales and Shama Sawant, are doing heavy doorbelling right now and trying to use grassroots donations and grassroots volunteers as a way to counter the big money coming in against them in these races. And it's a fine time to volunteer. If there's a council member that you particularly like or a district that you're in where you want to see somebody elected in particular, they can always use your time if you don't have the money. And it goes in your money, too.
It's also a good time they're having, continuing to have a lot of debates that people can, you can attend most,
yes,
of the time. Although I've seen some that appear to be invite-only events.
Yes, but
one put on by the SPD, as we just mentioned.
Yes, there's one coming up that we'll mention in events at the end of the show that I believe is tomorrow.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that.
But again, good resources to help you make your decisions, as well as their websites. City of Seattle, I believe, does video, short video pieces with,
yes,
each candidate. So
it's the equivalent of the voter's pamphlet statement, but on video.
So you have time to fully inform yourself prior to when those ballots land in another 10 days or whatever it is.
Yep.
All right. We're getting close to starting to national news. Just want to quick mention that I noticed also this week that KCPQ 13, the Fox affiliate, is now, apparently there is a national emphasis on this to start airing the national anthem each day.
Oh, awesome.
Because, and, you know, that's been missing.
And because Fox has the contract for NFC home games, they carry all the Seahawks home games and all their interdivision games as well.
And
so,
we know how football games do not already incorporate that in.
Yes. I mean, the Seahawks literally set off fireworks when they get to the bomb bursting air part of the national anthem. It's, mm-hmm, it's really kind of creepy, honestly. But
I wonder if that true of all major sports.
Well, they all air the national anthem, but professional football has a history of being very closely aligned with military.
Sure. They actually get funding from the Pentagon.
There's a lot of military terminology in the game, of course. The Seahawks do flyovers of military jets in some of their home games, et cetera, et cetera. It's a sport that tries to appeal to military thinking very much. Very much so.
So it made me wonder with our Fox affiliate doing this now, if this was already incorporated into the Sinclair Como 4, which is the Sinclair outfit locally, which is a very close to being, in some ways, outdoes Fox in their patriot, what they would consider patriotism.
They've done some serious hit pieces in recent weeks from a conservative standpoint as well that have gotten a lot of criticism.
Yeah. They're also the affiliate that distributes weekly editorial pieces that stations, all the Sinclair stations, are expected to run.
Yes.
Which
And now Como, I don't believe, has any pro football games on their network, but they do have college football. They carry Huskies. And there's, of course, National Anthem there, too, so...
All right. And then finally, we might have touched on this before, but the Times had another article this week, just again talking about the big picture here of homelessness in Seattle and who's really running things. The PSKS youth shelter is closing at the end of this year.
Yeah, which is really sad. Peace for the Streets, Bring Kids from the Streets, was along with Roots, our neighbors here in this building, who are going to have to be moving soon. They're one of the few grassroots shelters that were remaining in operation that really emphasized allowing the guests, the kids in this case, to have a say in how the shelter is run. And the city really doesn't like that model. They don't like homeless people having a voice. So we've seen that with their ongoing war against Share Wheel and Nicholasville, et cetera, et cetera. They do not like that model. And so the funding to help shelters like PSKS move when their buildings get gentrified and redeveloped and, you know, torn down to make way for new ugly condos or whatever, it's just has not been there from the city. And that's been a serious problem for PSKS.
Yeah. They, I believe, have 25 beds for the youth. So that's going to be a major loss.
That's one of the larger youth shelters in town. And the idea behind youth shelters is that you don't want those people... the guests mixing in adult shelters because, number one, they don't feel safe there. They certainly don't feel like their possessions are safe. Number two, they don't have a whole lot in common with the other people in those shelters, particularly the long-term homeless. And number three, you know, they're at a point in their lives where you really can make a difference in how their lives turn out. You're not condemning them to living perpetually in poverty. You can give them access to education, access to mental health and substance abuse programs and so forth. And it really makes a difference at that age. And having something like PSKS close is really quite sad and a loss for the community.
Yeah. It's amazing how many kids in attending both our regular schools and even the University of Washington, which is right across the street, are actually homeless.
Yeah, absolutely. Or their families are homeless, and you know, yeah, they've been having to struggle with that.
All right,
it's something like 20% of Seattle schools, or something, some outrageous percentage.
Yeah, I don't have the percentage in front of me, but I think you're right. It's pretty freaking close to 20%. Might actually be a little bit over. All right, moving on. Let's move on to national and.
Nothing happened this week.
Yeah, before you jump into the circus in D.C., I just wanted to touch on that Amber Geiger, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, was convicted this week of murdering Botham Jean, which was a big surprise. She is the police officer that was off duty that shot Botham Jean in his apartment. The story was is that she got confused, walked off. She lived in the same apartment building as him. Got off on the wrong floor, walked into his apartment. She said she thought that he was robbing her apartment and proceeded to shoot him dead.
That's problematic.
Turns out that she had been sexting her partner, who is married and I believe on the police force, with her. Moments before she walked into the apartment. Anyway, it was surprising. I think the big
surprise... So she wasn't really paying attention to the apartment until she walked in.
Yeah, Again, we're just assuming that we're getting, you know, some facts mixed in with this. The fact is that, you know, a police officer actually shoots her neighbor dead, and it sounded like a cover up ensued. The police department asked all the officers that were attending that were going to that situation afterwards to turn off their cameras. Video cameras were turned off in police cars. Anyway, so the fact that a police officer actually was convicted of murder was a major milestone this week. Doesn't happen very often.
It's true.
The flip side of that was she was only sentenced to 10 years for murdering her neighbor. So there was that this week.
Okay.
Now, let's move on to D.C. because I know you've got plenty of things to talk about there.
Well, that's certainly been a circus with all the Ukraine stuff. And I want to sort of back up and take a big picture before we start focusing on the details of things that happened this week, because there was a ton that happened this week. The two big takeaways this week, the two biggest stories, were the Inspector General of the State Department going to Congress on Thursday and giving them, after requesting an urgent meeting with congressional staff, because Congress isn't even in session until Monday, an urgent meeting with congressional staff in order to give them all these documents. And some of them were publicly released Thursday night. And what they show is that the Trump administration, number one, the attempt to get foreign entities to, and particularly Ukraine, to investigate the Bidens was much more extensive than was previously known. It went back really to last spring, Rudy Giuliani going to Europe on multiple occasions to meet with Ukrainian figures to try and pressure them into opening an investigation on Hunter Biden and, by extension, Joe Biden, and making several things, not just the $391 million in military aid that the Trump administration held up to the Ukraine, which Ukraine desperately needs because they're in a hot war with Russia, who is occupying the eastern third of their country, basically, the new administration in Kiev was also anxious to have President Zelensky have a photo op and a meeting in the White House and get that invitation. And what we saw were multiple texts back and forth between career diplomats who are generally non-political and have a lot of experience saying, wait a minute, demanding a quid pro quo for, on the one hand, for U.S. administration policy, to, on the other hand, something that personally benefits a re-election campaign. That's crazy. That's insane. I think those are the particular words of Bill Taylor, who is the acting envoy to Ukraine. He texted Gordon Sondland, who is the ambassador to the European Union. He got that job because he contributed $1 million to Trump's inauguration slush fund. And as it turns out, Mr. Sondland is a local kid. He lives in Mercer Island. At least his voter registration is in Mercer Island. His business is based in Portland. But he also owns the Hotel Theodore downtown at 7th and Pine. So, you know, next time you're looking for a nice boutique hotel to spend a weekend at, maybe that shouldn't be one of your first choices, because that's where the money will be going. In any event, he's in a lot of hot water at this point because he was basically covering for President Trump in that email exchange and literally consulted with Trump before sending back a very very generic Trumpian email, you know, saying, you know, we have to clean up corruption in Ukraine, and President Trump has made clear there's no quid pro quo. Well, yes, there is. And that's number one. And number two, it doesn't matter if there's a quid pro quo. You're still soliciting help for a domestic political campaign from a foreign government. That's blatantly illegal and very much what the Mueller report was about in last year. You would think Trump would know, but the other big development this week is that Trump was openly asking China for its assistance as well in investigating the Bidens. And as it turns out, that's not new either. He raised that in a phone call with President Xi of China in late June. So these things have been going on for months, and they've been covered up for months on this secret server that we've been hearing so much about, that is normally just used for national security, you know, things like active covert investigations where access needs to be severely restricted is what's going on. They were dumping transcripts of President Trump's phone calls with foreign leaders into that server to hide them from the public. And we don't know the contents yet of anything except what was in the original whistleblower's complaint. And that's something coming out today, is that there was a second whistleblower who was considering filing a complaint, who has more direct firsthand knowledge of some of these exchanges. But the that server contains transcripts of phone calls with, of course, the president of the Ukraine, but also President Xi of China. That's one of the conversations I just referenced in late June. Also multiple calls with President Putin. Calls with other different foreign leaders. Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, who Trump was conspiring with to try and downplay the Jamal Khashoggi murder last winter. It's remarkable that the Trump administration, number one, is trying to do this extensive, wide cover-up that's involving not just Trump, but also Vice President Pence, and also several cabinet members that have been implicated by some of those texts and emails. The ones that were released Thursday night are only a fraction of what was received by Congress. So we're going to be seeing more of those in the coming weeks, and what we're hearing is that even more, some of those were even more incriminating of various officials in the Trump administration. Rick Perry, the Energy Secretary, who famously couldn't remember that he wanted to abolish the Department of Energy in a presidential debate, and I think it was 2012, he abruptly resigned yesterday. He is implicated in some of the Ukraine phone calls. And this is sort of the big picture that I want to get to. Almost all of the Ukraine stuff, at one level or another, involves Russia. This is why we want to see the transcripts with Putin, because I think that's the big shoe that still has to drop, is what Trump is promising and what Trump is getting directions from Putin. Because everything that Trump is doing in these investigations, except for the Biden thing, which is Trump's own fixation, have to do with benefiting Russia. If you back up and look at the other thing that Trump was asking Zelensky to do in that now famous July 25th phone call, was to investigate CrowdStrike. And this is part of a right-wing conspiracy theory that has been completely debunked, but it's been put forward by Russia for the last couple of years, that Russia didn't have anything to do with the 2016 election. It was Ukraine that interfered on behalf of Democrats. And this this company called CrowdStrike that was tied to the Michael Steele dossier. And this is something that Rudy Giuliani was pressing the Ukrainian government to also investigate. And the idea behind this is, if it becomes U.S. official U.S. policy that it wasn't Russia that had anything to do with 2016, it was the Ukraine, then that pressures Congress to get rid of the sanctions on Russia, which was the first priority of the Trump administration, was to get rid of those sanctions because they deeply hurt Russia. Rick Perry, the energy secretary, was involved in the Ukraine phone call because of the transit of the pipeline that carries natural gas from Russia to the European Union. And that, again, is something that Russia very much wants to guarantee. And one of the reasons they're trying to take as much Russian territory, particularly along the route of that pipeline in areas in eastern Ukraine, where there's a lot of ethnic Russians, and they're supporting the local militias in that effort, and as well as the major port on the Black Sea in Crimea, which they absolutely took over in 2014. That's not a large land area, but it's very strategic because of the ice-free port on the Black Sea. This is something that Russia has been needing and wanting for years and years and years, going back to the Soviet Union, is an ice-free year-round port. They don't have it at Vladivostok on the Pacific. It's too cold. They don't have it on the Arctic Ocean, obviously. They don't have it at St. Petersburg, which empties into the Baltic. The Black Sea, they lost those ports when the Soviet Union broke up in 1989. Because Ukraine took them over. And this is something that Russia has been very much coveting. Not all the Black Sea ports necessarily. They don't want to go all the west, way west to Odessa, but they do want to have the Crimea. They do want to have the Gulf of Azov. If you look at a map, you can see why it's so important to Russia to be doing this. So that's one issue, is trying to overturn the conclusion of the U.S. government that Russia interfered in the elections in 2016. Trump has already said that he doesn't care that Russia invaded Crimea, and he's also been pressuring the Ukrainian government to sign a quote-unquote peace deal with Russia. That peace deal, which the Trump administration has been promoting, basically is a surrender by the Ukraine to not just the annexation of Crimea, but also the eastern provinces where there's a lot of ethnic Russians that Russia is now fighting to occupy, that would create autonomous territories there that would not be directly administered by Kiev. They'd be locally administered and probably by politicians that Russia can control. So these are all things that the Putin administration very much wants. And they've been watching Donald Trump happily check those boxes for them. And it raises the question, once again, why is Donald Trump so anxious to please Russia and so anxious to please Putin? Is he looking at investments after he's no longer president, which hopefully will be in the next couple months? We just don't know. And what happened this week is that investigation, which was originally very narrowly focused on that July 25th phone call, is now becoming much wider because it's involving at least four cabinet-level members. Rick Perry, who I mentioned just resigned, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, who had to admit last week that he was in on that particular phone call and has been up to his neck in terms of the State Department insisting that Ukraine launch this investigation, helping to pave the way for Rudy Giuliani to meet with some of these Ukrainian officials, even though he's a private citizen, et cetera, et cetera. You also have William Barr at the Department of Justice, who has now gotten two criminal referrals against Trump for his cover-up of these phone calls, one from the original whistleblower and one from the second whistleblower who is considering going to Congress with it, which may happen by the end of the weekend. We don't know. But that's two different criminal complaints about President Trump that Barr's Department of Justice has not only refused to prosecute, they refused to even investigate. They just completely ignored the referrals, which is highly unusual. But, of course, we've seen William Barr, since he was sworn in early this year, acting primarily as Trump's personal defense attorney, which makes sense because I'm not sure that Rudy Giuliani is competent in that role. But he's also not very competent in this, you know, covert spy go-between kind of role, because he has too big of a mouth and he loves being on Fox too much. And he just runs his mouth and, you know, inadvertently says, oh yeah, I did that. And the thing is, with the impeachment inquiry, there's already enough public information that Trump and Trump's allies have openly admitted to meet the definition of high crimes and misdemeanors many times over. The question is, for the Democrats, particularly the Democrats on the Intelligence Committee and on the Judiciary Committee, which will have the final say on this, how many articles of impeachment do you want? How wide do you want the inquiry to go? We've seen Vice President Pence being implicated this week in some of those texts for not only doing the exact same thing that Trump was accused of in his July 25th phone call, but going over there in person and making the quid pro quo explicit. So he's in hot water right now. So do you expand impeachment to include him? That's going to have a hard time sledding as long as the Republicans are having the majority, because they're not going to want to see a President Nancy Pelosi, who would be the third in line if Pence were impeached as well, or if Pence were impeached first, a la Spiro Agnew. You know, it's...
But you hear from a lot of people that their biggest fear of Trump being impeached is that Mike Pence will take over. So that could really sway a lot of people.
Well, sure. Pence is his own brand of danger. He's very much a Dominionist Christian. And Dominionism, for people who aren't familiar with it, is the belief that Christianity should be the official governing system of countries, that Christians should rule a country, and to heck with everybody else who's not a Christian. You know, it really is very much about establishing a theocracy. And that's not something that we've seen from Trump particularly. It's one of the few things we haven't seen from him. But it's very much the fear with Mike Pence. On the other hand, he probably wouldn't be in too good of a position to run for re-election next year. He would probably win the Republican nomination, but I think whoever the Democratic nominee is would have a pretty good chance against him. He doesn't have the kind of cult-like following that Trump does that automatically ensures that not just evangelicals, but you know, everybody with access to Rush Limbaugh's Daily Show or Fox News or whatever is a cult follower of Donald Trump. And you know, you see on conservative media this past week where they're really kind of scrambling to figure out how to defend against this, because there is an acknowledgement that there was serious criminality involved here, at least an acknowledgement by some of the hosts. Some of the others are saying, oh, it's no big deal, you know, all the presidents do this. Well, no, they don't. And you know, you see them saying, well, there was no quid pro quo, and they have to walk that back a day later when the texts come out. We're seeing so much come out so quickly, and the nature of this expanding so rapidly, that it's very hard to predict even what we'll find out next week. And there's going to be a number of critical testifiers before Congress next week. People who were formerly in the administration, the former ambassador to the Ukraine, who was forced out because as a career diplomat, she was sort of blocking Rudy Giuliani from having his way with the Ukrainian government, and a number of other people that really have had critical roles in this mess. So we'll have a lot more to talk about next week.
All right, well, I guess we better start bulking up on our food.
Yeah, learn how to speak. Learn how to speak complex Ukrainian names. That's the other challenge.
All right. Anything else on that?
Let's move on.
Okay. Also this week, there was coverage in the, I believe it was the New York Times, about U.S. has plans to collect DNA from detained immigrants. This is a very disturbing development. It hasn't been, nothing's been finalized yet, but just the concept of basically collecting DNA from people that are not, have not been convicted of crimes is pretty sure goes against the norms.
Yeah, they want to do that basically for everybody entering the country on the assumption that every immigrant is a potential criminal, which is, you know, mind-bogglingly racist, among other things. We also saw the U.S. Trump administration floating a proposal to deny immigrant visas to anybody who can't prove they can pay for health care, which would eliminate a lot of Americans, actually, from living in America. But this is particularly immigrants. So what they're saying is you can't even come into the country unless you can prove that you can pay for a medical crisis. So you'd have to buy your way into the United States with a substantial chunk of money, because that, you know, a night in the hospital is $20,000. So it's unclear what the standard would be for paying for a health crisis, whether it means you have insurance from your Western national insurance system, which most Western countries except the United States have, or whether that would cover anything in the United States, or whether you just have a lot of cash on hand, or you're just bringing in a lot of gold and jewelry. It's hard to say what the standard is yet. They haven't published it, but it again is given that the Trump administration has drastically reduced the number of visas that it allows for people coming into the country. I think under Obama it was something like 120,000, and it's now down to 15,000, something like that. It's not an exact number, but it's pretty close. It really tells you where they're coming from in terms of just trying to wall off the borders, literally.
Well, and speaking of walling off the borders, another item from the New York Times this week was talking about Trump's intentions or vision for what he had hoped for the wall and stopping people from crossing the southern border. And to quote directly from the article, the president had often talked about fortifying a border wall with a water-filled trench stocked with snakes or alligators prompting aides to seek a cost estimate. He wanted the wall electrified with spikes on top that could pierce human flesh. After publicly suggesting that soldiers shoot migrants if they threw rocks, the president backed off when his staff told him that that was illegal. But later, later in a meeting, aides recalled he suggested that they shoot migrants in the legs to slow them down.
Yes, which given military weapons, shooting somebody in the legs is a good way to have them bleed out. So it's basically condoning murder. And
assuming any part of the leg even survives from where it's hit.
Yeah, and you know, Trump really wants to kill brown people, basically, is what it boils down to. It's beyond appalling, and says a lot about what his mentality is toward immigrants coming across the southern border. Notice nobody's mentioning this along the 3,000-mile border with Canada. We seem to think those people are okay, even though Canada is taking in far more immigrants per capita than the United States has in the last couple, 3 decades. It's no longer an entirely white country either. If you go up to Vancouver for a weekend, you'll see that yourself. It's a heavily non-white city at this point, and a lot of money came in from Hong Kong, for example, after the repatriation in 1999. Toronto is a heavily non-white city, Montreal, etc. A lot of the urban centers in Canada are heavily ethnic at this point, and for whatever reason, Trump hasn't glommed onto that quite yet.
And one more quick item before we go to events. I wanted to end on a positive note.
Why not?
just be different. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law making it legal to create public banks now in California. So
yeah, and that's really exciting. Of course, there's been a local group here that's been pushing for Washington to create a public bank. For years and years, and they've been getting more and more traction over the years.
Slowly
but surely. But it's a really good idea. North Dakota has had one for decades that has been very successful. So there is a model out there. And we'll see what California does, because California is a much more influential example if public banks actually get created down there.
Yeah. They seem to be ahead of most of the rest of the states.
Yep.
So events.
Yeah. Quite a few coming up, including going on right now. It started at 1 o'clock, but we probably should have mentioned it at the beginning. Relocation Resistance on Black Mesa. It's a presentation by Indigenous Dene and their allies. This is a struggle that's been going on for many, many years, going back to the 1980s even, with Peabody Coal trying to expropriate land that rightfully and resources that rightfully belong to the Dene Nation. That is at Pipsqueak Gallery, if you want to go join that. It's at 16th and East Spruce in the Central District. Coming up Monday, Monday is what I was thinking of. Seattle City Council candidates are gathering to talk about cultural issues. That will be free at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca. That's the first of 3 nights that something interesting is going on at Town Hall. Tuesday night, Democracy in Decline. After local media disappears, what next? It's a panel. It's a very good panel with Matt Gertz from Media Matters, my friend Marcus Green, who was a founder of South Seattle Emerald and more recently was at the Seattle Times, and another friend of mine is Erica C. Barnett, who's been doing a lot of invaluable reporting on her blog lately, The C is for Crank. Go check that out. The panel is moderated by another friend of mine, David Goldstein, formerly of Cairo Radio and Horse's Ass Blog, etc. It's $5. It's at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca. Wednesday night, also at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca, The Biggest Lie Ever Told, Post-Prison Education. That will be with Pete Early. That's also a $5 admit. That's at 7:30 on Wednesday night. Okay.
I think that's it.
I think that was it.
For events, anyway.
Yes, that is correct.
All right.
So lots to check out. Yes. And And as you mentioned, there's other candidate forums for various districts going on out and about town.
Keep your ears peeled for them.
Absolutely.
Can't remember.
I'm not going to track each district individually because there's a lot of them.
But yeah, always good to go to and throw a question at the candidates, you know?
Yes, because they have to answer them.
In theory.
Yes. I didn't say they had to answer them directly.
Yeah.
Or
right.
Well.
So we will see you next week, right?
Yes.
All right.
We'll be back next week. And we'll be talking about ballot measures for the general election next week.